evenings. They are getting dark. I was lying in the bed last night and said, "Oh no, flip it." And I jumped out and I put on the heating. I said, "I have to do it. It's just, it's cold." And I was looking at the window and it was dark and it was wet. And it does sound to me like the perfect excuse to escape to the cinema and disappear into another world. But when it comes to my choice of movies, Brian, I have to tell you, horror just doesn't make the list for me. Not the gore fests that are on offer these days anyway. And yet they do appear to put bums on seats. People, uh-huh. it seems, love to be scared. For me, though, I have to say some of the most memorable films are the ones that kind of get right inside your mind and they kind of linger there. You know, the chilling and curdling your blood with every footstep, every creaking door. The type of film, in fact, that could turn something as ordinary as your daily shower into an opportunity for fear. And it's worth remembering that some of the greatest directors cut their teeth on horror movies. Did you know that Francis Ford Coppola made his very first film, a horror titled Dementia 13, right here in Ireland in 1963? Well, I'm joined, as I say, by a man who was more than happy to immerse himself in the dark realm of horror, filmmaker Brian Redden. Brian, welcome, as always, to the programme.
Thank you, Angus.
I believe you actually met Francis Ford Coppola this summer in San Francisco. We'll talk about that later on.
I did.
You know. But why do the psychological horror films win out over the kind of the modern gore fest? Because I like, say, The Exorcist just about. Yeah. I like Alien. Yeah. You know, for me, one of the scariest things I saw was when they put the night vision goggles on Clarice and when they're trying to search
that
kind of terror does it for me. But mm-hmm. a knife through the eye or, you know, people's arms being sawed off or throats being cut, I hate it.
Well, that's kind of the most popular form of horror now. Unfortunately, we've got to the point where censorship laws have, you know, aren't what they used to be. So we can show a lot more gore. We can show a lot more torture. We can show a lot more of the horror of these movies. So we're at the point now where really that's what people want. That's what people demand. That's what people are looking for. And they are making an awful lot of money. I mean, you mentioned there, I mean, these kind of slasher films. For example, the Saw movies, which I presume you hate.
Oh, I wouldn't watch them. I mean, I'd be petrified and I'd have nightmares after them anyway. But
well, they've coined
them.
The term torture porn for these, is the term they use, because that's almost what it is. It's almost pornographic at this point. They are the most successful horror movie franchise of all time. According to the Guinness Book of Records, the seven Saw movies have taken over $1 billion worldwide. And these have outsold the Halloween movies, the Friday the 13th movies, the Psycho movies, which you played a bit of Psycho. There's been a lot of Psychos. Unbelievable. So people like this kind of stuff. And it's interesting. So why do we like them? And it's a good question. And it's actually a question that people have been studying for years. It's actually a whole science of fear, they call it, believe it or not. I got Freud and Jung and all these guys were studying it. And on one level, people say it's part of our genetic makeup. It's part of our DNA. And it goes back to being hunter-gatherers, right? So when we were out and we were hunting for food, you know, we might have been jumped on by a lion at any moment or a saber-toothed tiger or whatever that was trying to kill us, right? So we had to have a defense mechanism and we had to have our nerves on edge and we had to train ourselves to be ready for these moments. So this part of our DNA was back in those days, right? Now, we're not going to be jumped on by a lion on the way to the shops now anytime soon.
Right, but we need to keep that.
But we need to keep our nerves on edge. Okay. This thing is part of our genetic makeup. So we, in order to do that, we need these frights. We need to give our nervous system a kind of a revving up. We need that jolt. And that's all part of what makes us. And what's
do we
part
need
of
it more
DNA.
In our 20s and 30s than we do in our 30s and
40s? Which
is
probably why you hate them so much. Apparently, younger people,
careful what you're going to say now.
The younger you are, the more you seek out these thrills and these sensations. The older you get, and studies have been done on this, thousands and thousands of countless studies. Apparently, the older you get, the more you realise that life is scary enough.
Yeah. You know? And ordinary life is scary.
Ordinary life is scary enough, and you're alive to the possibilities of danger all around you.
Do we not enjoy the drama of being afraid, though?
Yeah, I think that's part of it too. We just enjoy a good fright. I mean, people like to go in and look, life can be quite predictable, so we like unpredictabilities. We like to be able to go in and the drama of the fright and the shock. I think it's going to just. Because, and the thing about the horror movie is that we know it's going to be okay in the end. So it's okay for you to allow yourself to be frightened during that hour and a half because you know it's all going to end up okay. Mm. By and large, the bad guy is going to get killed. The bad guy is going to die in the end. Inevitably, that's what happens in a horror movie. So you know at the end of it all, the world will be put to right. So you allow yourself to be frightened for those.
I was just thinking the kinds of things that scare me. And I do remember in my youth doing a film story, and this was the most scared I ever was. Mm-hmm. I was doing an air sea rescue where the lads came along in a helicopter and they actually dropped me into Dublin Bay with the camera crew. They flew off and then they came back and they winched me back up. Okay, so they had to drop me in for, or I had to jump out first of all, you know, and then they flew off and then they came back so that they could film. There's the guy in the water. Okay, I was lying in a flotation-y kind of a suit, so there was no danger of me sinking, right? But I was grand. I went into the water and I was okay for about 4 or 5 or 6 seconds. And then I started imagining all of the things in the deep. Jaws, sharks. I was absolutely petrified that something was going to come up and eat me. Now, in Dublin Bay, I don't know what it would be, whether it would be a shopping trolley or something. But I was absolutely scared. Over. So I would be, in a way that I would prefer a hint of nudity in a movie than a full frontal. So do you know what I mean? The only good thing I'll have to say, Brian, as well, though, I think I do believe that war veterans and amputees are now getting extra jobs in gore movies because they put on a prosthetic onto them, then they can slash it off with a knife, or you know, and it looks as though you've cut the arm off. So at least there's a bit of work done for people. Well,
yeah.
But you know what I mean. You know?
Yeah.
Well, take us back to the history then. What are the early? What are your memories in terms of the research you've done of where the early movies in horror were?
Well, horror's always been there. Hmm. So it starts. I mean, we go back to even before movies. I mean, listen, the fairy tales we tell our kids are full of horror. Hmm. There's poison apples and wicked witches.
Hansel and Gretel.
They're terrifying. Yeah, you stop and think, Humpty Dumpty falls off a wall and smashes into pieces. Yeah. Like, you know, even
now
the most simple. She comes over and, you know, Snow White gets a poisoned apple by a wicked old. It's like, you know, they're there from the very early days in nursery rhymes, in fairy tales. So we're kind of brought up on horror and gore and fantasy and things like that. The movies copped on very early on. In the 1890s, there was horror movies made. Thomas Edison, who was one of the pioneers in film, in 1910, he made Frankenstein. So one of the very first films was a horror film. And horror kind of, it grabbed people. It was easy to do. You know, it worked very well. It worked very well on film. If you think about it, right? If you have horror, and horror, I think, works in two mediums. It works very well in the printed medium. So obviously Stephen King and things like that, books are great at terrifying you. And it works
because your imagination is there. And that's the thing I'm talking about when you're lying on the water thinking something's going to eat you from underneath.
Bless.
And it works brilliantly, though, on screen. But horror doesn't work on stage, for example. There's never been a successful stage horror. It can't work on stage. It just doesn't.
Woman in Black
is probably the only example of it.
It's a very successful play. And where you have a total blackout in the theatre.
And that's run for years. But can you think of another one? They don't really work on stage.
Opera.
Yeah, but would you call that a horror though, would you?
No, but you do get a bit of a fright here and there. You do jump.
Yeah. Well, I've been frightened in the theatre a lot and it's not going to see horror plays, I'll tell you that. But just awful plays. But by and large, the film medium, I think, really, really adores horror. So in the very early days, 1920s, you know, movie stars, the early movie stars were all horror stars, Lon Chaney and people like that. Mm. And then when it gets into the 30s, I think the 30s is the high point of horror, because in the 30s, Universal bought the rights to all these monsters, and they're very famous Universal monsters, which would include Frankenstein, Dracula, the Wolfman, the Mummy, the Invisible Man, all these kind of movies. And these movies became very, very popular in the 1930s and 1940s. People were flocking to the cinema to see them. Stars like Bela Lugosi were created, Boris Karloff, Lon Chaney Jr.
Yeah, we associate them with the birth of
horror. We associate them with the birth of the horror movie.
Yeah.
And Bela Lugosi, for example, he was a perfect... I mean, he was from Transylvania. He was born to play Dracula, you know.
What about The Blob?
The Blob, yeah. Do you know the very first Blob? Do you know who starred in the very first Blob?
Brian, who starred in the very first Blob?
I'll tell you, his real name. He went under his real name. His real name was Terence McQueen at the time. And he was the juvenile lead in The Blob. He then subsequently became Steve McQueen. So he's actually in The Blob. One of the guys been chased by this massive, big, mutant fungus from out of space is actually Steve McQueen.
Wow.
So the 30s and 40s, you have all these classic horrors. And that, I think, is the period, the high point of horror. And audiences flocked them and they were huge and they were really popular, but I think they've all dated. I don't think anyone would be scared by Bela Lugosi as Dracula
and
now.
Is that because technology has moved on now? We want CGI, you want to see the reality of what's happening.
Yeah, I think back in those, I mean, first of all, the acting was very wooden. It was very and by everybody involved. The scripts were pretty awful, and with the exception, I think, of James Whale's version of Frankenstein or The Bride of Frankenstein, which was very good, they don't really hold up now because they're just very old fashioned. They're very hokey, you know, and there isn't any effects in it, and the horror is very, very over the top and melodramatic. So I don't think they really stand up very well.
Talking about the effects, I want to talk about music for a moment. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to play a piece of music now. And I don't know whether this is because it's in 7/4, you know, seven beats in each section or whatever. And my memory of this piece of music is it's from The Exorcist, but written by Mike Oldfield.
Brilliant, yeah.
But my mother, who won't be listening today because she's not around at the moment, she's somewhere else. But she used to get because I loved it. I played the album in its
and it wasn't
totality.
Written for The Exorcist.
No, not at all. No, it was part of the concept album.
Yeah.
It's called Tubular Bells. But she used to get physically ill. I don't know whether it affected her heartbeat because of the 7-4. Anyway, see, does this send a shiver up your spine? Tubular Bells there. I'm glad Mam isn't listening to that. But you do transport yourself back into the film when you see that once you've actually seen it. So how important is the music, do you think?
I think it's vitally important, you know. And that's an interesting example, because that wasn't written for The Exorcist. Although you can't imagine The Exorcist without that. I mean, you first hear it when, I think it's Max von Sydow, I think it's that character, or the Jason Patrick, when the priest first appears outside the house where the girl possessed by the devil is in, you hear Tubular Bells the very first time. And then it's associated with that devil character all the way through the piece. But it wasn't written especially for The Exorcist. They just took it and they thought that's going to work really well. And now you can't imagine one without the other. It's brilliantly, brilliantly evocative. But I think music is vitally important. You played Psycho early on, Bernard Herrmann's score, those strings. I mean, you mentioned Jaws earlier on, John Williams' score. All you've got to do is hear that cello and you know
exactly where you are.
What is it? It's a shark that's going
to
attack you.
Just when you thought it was safe to go back in the
water. Who'd have thought
the
three or four notes?
Danger lurks.
Who'd have thought the three or four notes could do that, you know? John Carpenter, I think, is a perfect example of a guy who uses music really well in horror movies. So Carpenter was kind of like the king of horror in the 1970s. With Halloween and The Thing and movies like that. And he composed all of the soundtracks himself as well. So, and they're all kind of synthy, very synthesizer kind of sounds, some and very sparse and bare kind of a sound, but quite horrific. And they really, 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 really help with the movie, really help with the characters and help you get inside the characters' heads. So I think John Carpenter really understood the power of music in terms of film. Another great example, of course, is The Omen. You know, I think it's called Ave Satani.
Well, here it is. Certainly brings back, by the way, John in Cork says The Wicker Man, horror at its best.
Oh,
the original
is fantastic. That music is Ave, I think it means Hail Satan, is what it means.
And Ave Santana. Yeah. But that is very, I'm just thinking, you cut your teeth on young people's television, okay?
Yeah.
And on occasions, you would have a situation where somebody, as the kind of, oh, I'm sorry, the forfeit you've missed, would get Green Gunge bucketed over them, okay?
I look forward to that.
But that moment in The Exorcist when the Green Gunge, which is presumably exactly the same stuff as children's television, programs.
Pea soup it was.
Pea soup, huh?
Pea soup. That's what they used. Pea soup. Linda Blair, when she spews it
out across. That and the 360 spin of the head, I think.
That was
fantastically terrifying moment.
Horrific moment. And her voice, believe it or not, was the voice of an Oscar-winning actress called Mercedes McCambridge, who was a brilliant actress. And they used her voice for the voice of the demon coming out of Linda Blair. But you were talking about The Omen.
I'm a bit like Angus. I'm not a fan of horror movies, you know. But when you get a really good one and when it gets inside your head, it's fantastic. And I love Damon the Omen. Damien. Are you sure it wasn't Damon?
No, it's Damien.
All right, okay.
I felt sorry for anybody who was called Damien who was born around about that time.
Yeah, but it was,
lovely child. Damien, oh no!
No, it's The Omen. But there's great scenes in that that really stick in my head. But you were just saying, the thing about a horror film is you go, you watch it and you think, oh, that's grand, blah, blah, blah. You know, the person, they'll all be happy in the end. But they weren't happy in the end of this. I mean, The Omen ended up hanging out with the President of the United States, and then we had 1, 2 and 3 or whatever forward. So the problem is that if you go through this whole spectrum of an hour and a half where your heart's in your mouth, where you're jumping out of your seat, where you can't look, your hands in your head, and all that because of everything. And then you think, well, it'll be all right because it'll be happy ever after in the end. And then it's not, you know. So, like, what are you going to do about that? Or what have you got to say about that, Brian?
Well, in that one, in the case of The Omen, it is actually okay at the beginning. It's only after, you know, when you get to the very end after the credits and all, you see the kid again, you go, oh, hang on a second. Mm-hmm. So they actually do give you a kind of resolution. And then it's towards the end, they go, hang on a sec, we're going to stick it to you. But that's a movie that's been designed to be a sequel and part of a franchise. So you're just part of the franchise. But mind you, in Halloween, the bad guy's got at the end of Halloween, but he still makes an appearance in Halloween 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Do you know what I don't
understand?
They often
appear. But I think in terms of serials and franchises, you know, there is a kind of resolution within the story itself, but the character does continue on.
What I don't understand is, you know, the way I might say to you, Brian, will you come over to the house and we bring a box set of comedy or a box set of this movie?
You've
or
never
that
said
movie
that to me.
Well, if I was to say, like, but Ailish O'Shea, who's a researcher on the Mooney Show, right? Right? She thinks nothing can be better than a night in where she says to her mates, come on over, and they get three or four real, like, seriously horrible, gory horror movies and a pot of tea and some biscuits. And they have the night in.
She was saying they're having a horror-thon.
Does that make sense to you? Can you understand that?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And is it a kind of a truth or dare to see who's going to be the weakest?
I think in that case, it's good to look back on stuff that you haven't seen, and like classic horrors that, you know, everyone talks about, but, you know, you said, oh, I must get around to watching that. And to watch it in company, it's a great thing. I mean, it's like going to the cinema. I think it's a great idea. I think, why not?
You know? Bern has been on to say, other really scary ghost films I saw as a child in the 60s were The Woman in White, Corridor of Mirrors, and the most scary of all was The Innocents with Deborah Kerr as a governess in a strange, isolated mansion. Absolutely terrifying. Mm-hmm. Salem's Lot, I beg your pardon, Salem's Lot was a great horror film, says Tom.
Yeah, one of my favourites.
And then PK, who's in Kildare, says there was a French film called Martyrs. Once you see it, you won't want to see it again. An awful sick ending to the young woman. So that's this gore thing again that I don't understand that, but why people would enjoy that.
Well, as you say, like, that's the point we've come to now. And I think that what kind of happened, if you look back at the decades, by the time we got to the 70s, 1970s, we were into the slasher, the kind of slasher flick and the serial killer flick. So there you had movies that were, you know, Halloween with Jason was the character in that. And then you had Freddy Krueger and Nightmare on Elm Street. You had Friday the 13th, all those kind of movies. So they were very popular in the 70s. And I think, you know, by the time the 80s and 90s came around, they'd been done so much that it was time to parody them. It was time to look at them and say, you know what, they're just so stupid. Mm. Don't go into the woods. Don't run down this way on your own. Put a top on, for God's sake. Do you know what I mean? It was just so obvious, sure, and so cliched. So it was time to parody them in films like Scream and Urban
Scary
Legend.
Movie 1, to all, the
all those kind of movies. Scary Movie 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And now that we've had all that, we've come full circle and we're back around to
some very scary stuff.
Scary stuff,
okay,
yeah.
Stay with us, Brian, because there's lots more I want to talk to you about, particularly as well. I know you're just back from, was it 10 or 12 weeks in San Francisco with your five children, which I think was a great adventure. I want to hear all about that. And if you've got any favourite horror movies you want to tell us about, please do get in touch at 1850 715 900, text the programme on 51551, or email mooney@rte.ie. I watched The Birds when I was younger. It scared me to death, the Alfred Hitchcock's Bird. Martyrs wasn't horror. It was just a glorification of violence. I stopped it halfway as I didn't want that in my mind. I'd agree completely. Ryan Redden is here with me. We're discussing scary movies. I'm not alone. I'm delighted. Well, let me find it here. To this day, I will not watch The Exorcist alone, and I'm a 46-year-old married man with kids. It absolutely horrifies me for hours afterwards. The only reason I'm saying that is Brian called me a wimp during the new.
I'm just wondering.
You did. You said you're a wimp, didn't you?
I did.
Brian,
yes.
You know the way it's all gore and gunge and, you know, chopping up people and everything. Do men like horror films more than women, do you think, or is that far too much of a generalisation?
No, I think that's probably true. I think, just from my own experience, I know my missus hates them. She can't stand them. She doesn't like them. And actually, it does bear out, because I was looking at some research yesterday, and it seems that the vast majority of the audience members for horror movies these days are young adult males. So you're right. I mean, it's basically men seem to get a kick out of them much more than women do.
House of Wax had me looking into presses and underbeds before sleep for years, says Joan.
House of Wax. Yeah. I don't know which one that is. There was original House of Wax that was made by Roger Corman. That kind of waxing would scare the life out of me. But the original one was really scary. But then they did a remake of it with Paris Hilton, of all people, was in it.
No, oh, that well-known actress.
That well-known actress. She dies in the first 3 minutes. Oh, that was melts off. Okay, so that wasn't so bad. But it was a pretty scary one, all right.
Carrie, the scariest film, finishes with the graveyard scene. Hand shoots up from the grave out of the blue.
Oh, yeah.
And they're actually making a sequel to that now, believe it or not. Another one.
Somebody else, an anonymous texter, said the 1974 version of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I still get nightmares when it's on. You see, I don't think that's a good thing, you know. There's enough rubbish in the world today and enough people. By the way, the West End Theatre hit Ghost Stories, written by Jeremy Dyson and Andy Nyman, has shown that horror can work on stage.
Yeah, that's your Hoover up.
I hate scary movies. I watched Marnie years ago on my own. At the end, a hand came out of the grave. Afterwards at night, I had to run up the stairs, as the stairs were open ones, and kept visualising a hand. You see, that's the thing I'm talking about, that notion of in your imagination you'll start to see everything. It's terrible, you know.
Well, do you know the best example that recently I found was, I went to see The Woman in Black. You mentioned it as a stage play. Have you seen the film version of it with Daniel Radcliffe? It's brilliant. Have you seen it?
No.
It's really, really scary. There is no blood, no gore, none of that kind of stuff. It's a real traditional horror film that just gives you a fright. And it was absolutely terrifying. Really well done, really well made. And it's gone back to basics.
Well, obviously you're a very brave man because you can watch all of these, but you're a very, very, very brave man because you got yourself, your wife and your 5 children and you headed to San Francisco for what, 10, 12, 14 weeks?
10 weeks.
Why?
Just to experience America as a family, to be honest. Which, I mean, I spent a lot of time in the States working over there. And I love Americans. I love America. I love everything about them. They get an awful hard rap. You know, people always go on about them with their have a nice day and, you know, can I help you, sir, and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, I find them to be incredibly genuine people and just absolutely charming. They can't do enough for you. And I spent a lot of time working out there and I really wanted the kids to go out and experience America. And
you
see
did
what
all your
like.
Sort of Route 66 programs for Chichi Kahar and Dahi and
Route 66, you know, is probably one of the most amazing things anybody can do in their lifetime. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky enough to do it once. And
did you?
Yeah.
A motorbike or?
No, in a car on the Jerry Ryan show. Just heaven. It was amazing.
And like, don't you get to see a part of America that most people don't get to see?
Stunning.
And just real genuine people who are quite eccentric and quite, and they have to be eccentric in terms of Route 66 because they've been bypassed by a major motorway. And they have to do things to get you to come off that motorway to say hello. So that's why you get the world's largest ball of twine or a massive 90-foot high rocking chair. Mm. And they just have to be eccentric. San Francisco is a city I found that, you know, of all the places I've been in America and of all the 50 states in America, I've been in 48 of them, believe it or not. I visited
what
and worked
two are you
48
missing?
Of them.
I bet never. You. Alaska?
Never been to Alaska.
Okay.
Yeah. And I've never been to Ohio. I don't know why I've never been to Ohio. I've been to Hawaii, for God's sake. I've never been to Ohio. Okay. Anyway, so I spent a lot of time in the States. San Francisco, to me, was just a city that was just very welcoming. You know, it's a very safe city. It's a clean city.
What did they make of you and your wife and 5 children?
Well, they thought we were nuts, you know, because people in America don't, they have 2.5 kids. That's it. They do not have more than that. They just, because they can't afford it. Because the state of America at the moment, it's just so expensive to raise a kid. I had long conversations with people out there and the general figure you get back is $300,000 a year. $300,000 a year. A year is what it would cost you to look after a kid. And that would be schooling. And I was going, get out. That's
people
not,
don't
that's
earn $300,000.
You couldn't earn that kind
so
of
you
money.
You needed but they were taking, $500,000.
I know, yeah. A year. I said, nah, not a chance. But they were factoring in bringing them to college and all this kind of stuff later on, right? So if you want to start, it would cost you $300,000 a year to look after a kid over there if a kid was in their teens and they were going to college. But after, I don't think so. But it's just very expensive. Anyway, you look at it, it's very expensive to raise kids in America. You pay from everything from, you know, primary school right through to college. That's just very, very dear. So when you're going around with 5 kids, you think you're a multimillionaire, which I'm not, I hasten to add.
Not anymore, you're not.
No. And they see you on a bus out there, which is like, you know, so you like we were getting on buses and you're getting on a bus with 5 kids and big, massive double buggies or strollers, as they call them out there. But you know what? And the Yanks look at you and they think you're mad, but they jump up to let you sit down and like old people are getting off their seats to give them to you. Like,
now,
you know,
we started the item talking about Francis Ford Coppola making his first horror movie here, Dementia 13, in Ireland in 1963. You actually got to meet him. And for you, somebody who eats, sleeps and drinks and breathes everything to do with movies, that must have been incredible.
It was absolutely amazing. He was making, it's interesting, Francis Ford Coppola, this is a guy who's made 3 Godfather movies, Apocalypse Now, The Conversation. I mean, he's a brilliant, brilliant genius. And he can't get a movie made these days. Nobody wants.
Why though?
Because I asked him that very question. Why can he not get, and he, do you know what his answer was? He says, all anybody wants to see now is vampires. That's all they give a damn about. If you haven't got a vampire movie,
forget about
they don't
it.
Want to know about it, you know? And that was basically it. And I said, but if you're Francis Ford Coppola, you go to a major studio with a script, surely they'd bite your hand off it. He goes, you would think, but no, they don't. Because the scripts he's bringing to people are very personal stories. And the guys he's pitching these movies to are kids who don't know his legacy and don't know the movies he's made, you know? So it's really interesting. interesting. So what he's done is he's kind of come full circle now. And he started to make these really personal movies. And he makes them, he goes anywhere in the world that'll give him money to make a film. He doesn't care where he goes. But the last one he made was called Betwixt. And he shot it in his own backyard. He owns a vineyard just outside San Francisco. So he shot it in his own backyard, used his own family in it, used friends to shoot it, got actors he knew who did it for next to nothing, and made it for very, very little money. And it's a horror movie, speaking of horror films, about Val Kilmer plays the part of a writer who stops off in a small town on a book tour and gets involved with all sorts of sinister goings on. And it's not a great movie, I have to say. So he was screening
it. Did you tell him that?
No, I did not. I loved your movie, Mr. Copeland. Thank you so much. Oh, you're a genius. It was brilliant. What part did you like most? All of it. But actually, it was awful. So he sat down and watched. Oh, it was awful. Anyway, he was having a screening of it, and he introduced the movie and was doing a Q&A afterwards. So he's one of my heroes. I thought, well, should we go along and see, you know, see if he's going to be there. And when we walked in, he actually greeted everybody who came in, shook their hands. How you doing? Welcome to my movie. I'm going, Francis Ford
it's
Coppola.
Like Daniel O'Donnell nearly.
Oh, yeah. Almost. Yeah. Sit down, watch the movie, enjoy the movie. Mm. I hope you enjoy the movie. I'm going, Jesus, this is fantastic. So you're sitting down watching the film, and then after the film, he did a Q&A session, and he was very witty and very clever and very... You know, he was taking questions from everybody and he answered everything. And one guy asked him, he said, "You know, are you going back to your roots now? Are you reclaiming your legacy with these small independent movies?" And he thought for a second, he goes, "I think when you've made three Godfather movies, your legacy is pretty much set, you know?"
Wouldn't you feel so stupid when you got around? Yeah. You did what's called in the business doorstepping somebody where you you go up and just, you don't take no for an answer.
But it was
so
funny.
Almost uninvited, you hooked up with them later.
Totally uninvited.
Okay, well, I was trying to be nice about it.
I asked him a couple of questions during the Q&A because I'd known that he made this film called Dementia 13 in Ireland, as you mentioned, in 1963, and I knew a bit about it, so I was able to say that to him. So he was going, "Oh yeah, how did you know about that?" So we got talking during the Q&A, but when the Q&A was over, they were getting them the hell out of there, you know. So I go, "To hell with this, I've got to go over and say hello to Francis Ford Coppola, get me photograph with him, you know." But they were taking him downstairs in the lift. I literally went over and stuck my foot in the lift, you know, to stop it. And I says, "Mr. Coppola, is any chance?" He goes, whoa, "What's going on?" I don't know what the hell he thought. I just want to get a photograph. Any chance we get a photograph? He goes, "Oh, you the Irish guy who was asking me the Irish questions?" I go, he says, "Oh, okay. So he came out and he goes, "Let's get our photographs." You get our photograph taken, and he says to me, "So how did you know about Dementia 13? So we're talking about that a little bit. You get the photograph taken. I said, "Listen, thanks very much. Sorry for keeping you so long. Lovely to meet you. I'm a real fan of your work." And he shook my hand and he said, "Ta falcha wrote."
Wow.
Yeah, he actually said that. And then I was like, "Oh my God, where did he get this from?" Got back in the lift and he was gone. My brief moment with him was over.
And you met Woody Allen as well, and that's a story for another day.
Yeah.
Listen, Brian, thank you so much. The texts are lighting up lots of people. We might share a few of those later on in the programme if we have time. Brian Redden, thank you very much. Texter Damien says, "Just back from 10 days in America, and I found everyone I spoke to there to be very nice and polite. The first grumpy, sour-faced person I saw..." Well, okay.
Do we know them?
No. Well, so the first grumpy, sour-faced person I saw was the custom officer in Dublin. That's a bit harsh. Now, earlier on, I was talking to Brian Redden about scary movies, and I just want to bring to your attention a gig on the 31st of October on Halloween night at the National Concert Hall here in Dublin. The RTE Concert Orchestra are repeating a fantastic concert that they first gave in 2010. What they're actually doing is playing Alfred Hitchcock's classic Psycho, okay, the 1960 movie. So you'll see the movie on screen and you'll hear every note of it played live by the RTE Concert Orchestra. These kinds of presentations are becoming more and more popular. It's a fantastic way to see a movie and then to experience the reality of the music score as it was written, so I can highly recommend that as well. Terry says, "Deliverance was a horrible movie, but I loved the banjo music."